Good morning. I'm going to call the Agriculture and Food Finance and Policy Division to order. We've got, again, another full agenda this morning, so I appreciate that everyone is here. We do have a quorum, so the clerk will note the roll. And we have some minutes from March 14th. Representative Brandt.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes for the meeting on March 14th.
All right. The minutes are before us. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We are getting into deadlines. So we've got lots of activity that we need to get working on. And we are going to be talking about the governor's budget bill on Thursday. We'll have the commissioner here and be able to kind of go through what that is. But as you know, people have brought forth many other bills. And so we're going to be able to compile an omnibus finance, ag finance bill, and so people can certainly let me know through email or through personal conversations things that they might be interested in. So we'll have plenty of opportunity to talk about that, but we're going to get started. We have lots of bills, and we're going to start with Representative Fisher, and he's got one on noxious weed control. So welcome to the committee, Representative Fisher, and we are going to move your bill. I'm going to have Representative Brand. Would you like to move?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I move House File 2237 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Ag Finance Bill.
Thank you. Representative Fisher, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 2237. The main purpose of this bill is to appropriate general fund dollars to the Commissioner of Agriculture to control noxious weeds, and particularly making sure that we're keeping a close eye on Palmer amaranth. I know that this is a weed that has been very disruptive. We don't want it to get a foothold in the state because it can be have huge negative impacts for our agriculture area. I do understand that this weed can be very damaging in row crop areas, particularly with corn and soybeans. In some states that have had problems with Palmer amaranth, they have had situations where the crop production can be reduced as much as 91%. So this is a weed that we want to keep vigilant for and make sure that we keep it from getting a foothold. I know it's starting in some areas, but we have to keep a very vigilant response on it. That's part of the reasons I'm offering the bill today.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. As I look at the bill, there's just a blank appropriation. Do you have an amount that you're considering?
Yes, the amount I was considering is $900,000 for each year.
Okay, that's helpful information. So do we have any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Fisher, of that total amount you're asking for, is that all going to the MDA, or will some be put back into the local county weed inspector's hands?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson. This would be something that would also be giving preference to local government units to be able to use those dollars to help address the issues as it crops up in their local areas, whether it be the county unit or local governments themselves.
Representative, anybody else? Yes, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Fisher, I see that the commissioner may use up to 4.5% of this appropriation. I'm wondering, I don't recall if they were able to use using 4.5% in the past. I'm just wondering if that's necessary and how we came up with that percentage.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton. In terms of the 4.5%, this is one that I was working with the Senate on. Senator Draheim is one that made the recommendation on the bill that I picked up from. So we were just using the figure that was used in the past.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we just want to make sure that the dollars go to the individuals that need them, is what I'm saying. And I don't know if they need that 4.5% to issue these if they're passed through grants. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. I know that we do have the department here. I don't know if they have any comment on this, but we'll let it stand for now. Okay. Any other questions from committee? And Representative Fisher, any testifiers for you? And anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? All right, I see none. So thank you, Representative Fisher. Representative Brand renews his motion that House File 2237 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Ag Finance Bill.
Thank you very much.
And next we move to Representative Detmer. House File 484. Representative Detmer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we're going to ask Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 484 be recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. And when we first heard this, or when we first got this, we thought we would just send you to Tax Committee, but I think Representative Hansen has the Environment Committee, and he, because there is a fiscal note related to DNR, he's requesting it go there. So we'll go through Ways and Means to Representative Hansen. But welcome to the committee, Representative Detmer, and we're happy to
Understood, Madam Chair and committee members. And again, House File 484 was passed last year. It was one of another bill that was part of an omnibus bill casualty. So we're coming forward again. And the bill would authorize immediate withdrawal of land enrolled in Metropolitan Agriculture Preserve. And when the state agency or other governmental unit acquires the land, the fee title obtains from the easement for the purpose of creating expansion public trails or parks. And with us today, we do have two testifiers, but I've got it down to one testifier. And I've asked Neil Soltis, a city administrator, to fill in here. And also behind me is the mayor of Scandia, Christine Majewski. So they both have been really, really pushing to get this through so they can finish the projects that they have in their area. So, Mr. Soltis.
Yes, welcome to the committee. Just state your name and then provide your testimony.
Neil Soltis. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. As Representative Detmer stated, you know, currently in Metropolitan Ag Preserve, there's a provision that for a landowner to initiate the expiration of the Ag Preserve designation takes an 8-year timeline. There's one exception to that, and that exception currently is that if the acquiring agency condemns or acquires the property through condemnation. What this bill would do is to broaden that so that would allow, and you know, one of the issue that we've been confronted is that there is a property that is the last link in the Gateway Trail where the DNR acquired voluntarily an easement over this property. So what this bill would do is allow properties acquired either through easement or fee simple by a governmental entity for parks or trail purposes to allow the acquiring agency to initiate those proceedings to cause the Metropolitan Ag Preserve designation expire. And that expiration would only cover that portion of the trail that is encompassed, that is being purchased for or purchased or acquired by easement for parks and trail purposes. In this specific easement, there the acquisition by the DNR took place in 2016, and it encompasses 0.8 miles along the western edge of a 210-acre property. The trail easement itself encompasses 7 acres of that property. So, you know, based upon the timing, the DNR has issued an expiration notice stating that work on the development of the trail can't occur until after December 2024. You know, the prior acquisitions by the DNR are already over a decade old. So, you know, what we're trying to do now that they have finally gotten this last piece of the trail is accelerate that process so that the Gateway Trail from William O'Brien State Park into Scandia can be completed.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? And I know I know that the mayor is here, and if she does want to step forward and state anything, I'd certainly welcome her to do that. I don't want to cut her out of this opportunity if she did come to the committee and perhaps would like to at least be recognized. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I'm Christine Majewski, Mayor of the City of Scandia. I'd like to thank you, first of all, for hearing us this morning. This is Scandia is a beautiful, scenic exceptionally beautiful scenic part of the outer skirts of the metropolitan area. We are a favored bicycling destination now because of our scenic beauty and also the other environmental offerings and historic offerings that we have, low traffic roads. But we have the opportunity here and have been pursuing it for over 10 years now to connect through the Gateway Trail to our downtown area from William O'Brien State Park to broaden the connection to historic Scandia and that we hope will be able to happen. So we were very excited when this last segment was procured by the DNR, and then the fact that it was in Ag Preserve presented something of an obstacle. So this, we see this because it's the openness of the site will remain, which is part of the Ag Preserve benefits. It will remain as part of the trail because it's a very small portion of the land, and the rest of the land will stay in Ag Preserve, so that the implications there will not be great. And because it is very specifically for our situation in Scandia, we hope that you will consider this and move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. All right. Any questions? And any other testifiers that wanted to speak in support or in opposition? Seeing none, I think Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll renew my motion to have House File 484 be recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you. That motion's before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and House File 484 is on its way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, Representative Bang. This is House File 2344. Welcome to the committee, Representative Bang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 2344 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Ag Finance Bill.
All right. The bill is before us. Please present your bill and introduce your witnesses.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm happy to present to you today House File 2344, requesting $1 million appropriation for the existing NDA Urban Agriculture Grant Program housed under AGRI. In March 2018, NDA announced $250,000 in grant funding for urban youth agricultural education and urban agriculture community development. Since then, approximately 2.46 million fund requests were received in over 65 proposals. This shows a high interest and popularity for urban agriculture. Urban agriculture has shown to have many meaningful benefits, from health to equity, by increasing access to fresh produce in food deserts, from employment and entrepreneurship opportunities, and sustaining environment with increased air quality and preservation of green space. I have a testifier here with me today whose organization has directly benefited from this funding as well.
Thank you, Representative Bang. So welcome to the committee. And just state your name, please, and then provide your testimony.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for having us. My name is Mia Ulysse, and I am with Appetite for Change based in North Minneapolis. I was here early February to have an informational hearing just a little bit about urban agriculture and the impacts in metropolitan areas on its ability to remediate inaccessibility to food access, as well as propose a number of other benefits, including deferring soil erosion, increasing soil quality, increasing air quality, and dismantling the hot zones, heat islands, if you've ever heard of them before, that you might incur in densely populated areas. So we're here today to state the case on our benefit from the Urban Agriculture Grant Program that's seated under AGRI as a direct grantee, as well as propose what we have here in terms of the bill to increase the funding to $1 million over the biennium. So we are funded through the first grant cycle of the Urban Agriculture Grant Program, and the funding went towards being able to contribute to our urban youth employment and training program. We employ around 100 youth year-round, around 50 during the summertime that are ages 14 to 17, and the youth that we serve are the youth that many organizations won't take because they might have had a less than stellar grade point average, or maybe they're facing displacement or homelessness. And with many youth programs, they serve a variety of youth within the metropolitan area, but there are many youth that are left out due to not qualifying and being eligible for reasons not necessarily of their control as someone who's a minor and subject to their own environments. So we teach these youth how to grow food. We get them out into our urban farm spaces. And many of them, they've never pulled out a carrot before. And I don't know, any of you, you know, the first time you realize where food comes from and, you know, a potato grows under the ground and a ground cherry, you know, you pluck from a bush and just the amazement that you feel when you're creating a connection between your food. That's what we do with our youth in North Minneapolis is we try to create a connection between food. We try to get them back into their ancestral roots, teach them growing practices for foods that they're familiar with. So the collards that you have at Thanksgiving table, you can grow these. You can grow them right here. You can grow them, you know, pretty much until the snow defrosts, all the way up until there's more snow, and being able to really connect them back into their food system. We're trying to grow urban food leaders that can assume land when our aging farming population in Minnesota progresses so that we're diversifying our farming population and sparking that interest and passion in the youth that are going to take our places going forward. We have a farmer's market where the youth are able to learn customer service, understand math and accounting and how that plays into their system. They're able to provide fresh options for people that are participating in SNAP and WIC. And ultimately, they are becoming, as youth, part of the solution in mitigating food insecurity in North Minneapolis, which is a really powerful thing to say to a 15-year-old that you can be a part of a solution that you see in your community. So what we had here with Representative Vang is a great amount of interest in terms of the funding for the Urban Agriculture Grant Program. This is something that is unique and a little interesting just because it benefits not only those that are living in densely populated areas like Minneapolis and St. Paul, but we also have seen indigenous communities from Red Wing, the Prairie Island Indian community being funded. We've seen extension funded in Virginia, Minnesota. We see peri-urban areas that are on the outskirts, such as Robbinsdale, being funded through this program. So it's not just for the metropolitan areas. It's really something that is meant to bring people together around their immediate food system and create an opportunity for those to be able to be engaged and have enough funding to carry this work forward.
Thank you. I know we'll have some questions or comments. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions as to how this money is processed. So first question is, once this money is put in place, it's in the Department of Agriculture. Are there grants that are applied to it, the Department of Agriculture? Is this money being put into an organization? Where exactly does that money reside?
Yes. So it's under the Department of Agriculture under AGRI. And it goes into a grant program and an RFP process that the Department of Agriculture manages.
Okay. Madam Chair, a couple more quick questions.
Yes, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So can you give me kind of an example of people that would, or organizations that would be applying for this grant money?
Yes.
Ms. Ulysses.
Yes. So we have an organization in the room, Youth Farm, who has applied and received funding as well. They have urban agriculture youth programming between the Minneapolis and St. Paul area and have their own similar works. We see organizations, nonprofits, such as churches that are trying to lift off opportunities for the youth that are in their communities to get involved with growing food. So we've seen indigenous communities, we've seen nonprofit organizations that are already doing youth development work, but we have also seen organizations that are trying to strengthen their food systems and find some approaches through aquaponics, which is what the community in Red Wing is doing, is looking at how they can create opportunities to increase economic vitality. So aquaponics, if you're growing tilapia, it's something where you can take a decent margin. You know, you're going to take a higher margin off of tilapia than you are going to take off of a head of lettuce. You can sell the byproduct of the fish emulsion, so you can use that as a fertilizer, so you can take funds off of that. And so it's a way that nonprofits that are looking to create impacts in their food system can look at systems that aren't just focused on youth and just focused on the community and the sentimental value, but how do you actually lift off that food ecosystem in your communities? And there are others that are approaching funding that are looking for these creative means through aquaponics, controlled environmental agriculture. So if you've ever heard of a fright farm, it's a shipping container essentially where you can fit 1.1 acres of food production into one shipping container. It's a really valuable use of space if you don't have it, whether you're in a metropolitan area or a peri-urban or rural area. And it allows you to be able to grow food without having to think about soil quality.
One final question.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in these grant applications, maybe there's a history or maybe there's an anticipation, so just a best guess sort of thing. What would be the average size grant out of this program to an individual, or is there kind of a range that you've seen?
I believe the maximum request is $50,000. I should be corrected if I'm wrong. So usually people, when they're applying for grants, they're going to ask for the maximum amount, right? Because it's their shot to be able to get as much funding as they possibly can. But there are other projects that are smaller for organizations that might not necessarily be as experienced, where they may request less. So,
thank you. Yes, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm a strong supporter of this. As you know, former Representative Karen Clark worked very hard on this, and she spent a lot of time in both of our offices probably, right? So a shout-out to former Representative Karen Clark. And, again, we said all along, this is about growing the youth, growing communities. It's more than just growing a carrot, right? And so I'm going to continue to be a strong supporter. And with that said, we also know that the Agri Fund has limited amount of dollars in it. And one of the fears early on by introducing new programs into the Agri Fund was that it'll dilute the other things that are taking place. And so I just want to raise that point. You know, we should all be encouraging our leadership to be supporting programs such as this, because we are seeing positive results. So I want to thank the testifier and thank you also, Representative, for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a great program. We should be supporting it.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. I do know that Mr. Carr is here. If
yes.
He wanted to come down to testify as well. Thank you, Ms. Ulysses. So we'll bring you down. Hello, welcome to the committee. If you want to state your name and provide some testimony to House File 2344.
Yes, my name is Marcus Carr. I am the program director at Youth Farm in the Twin Cities. Yeah. And I'm
sorry.
Want
to speak to the bill?
I do. This bill has been an important part of our programming at Youth Farm. I don't know if any of you have heard of what we do at Youth Farm, but we're kind of using food as a medium to create social change in our immediate environment. And we're starting with your babies, teaching them where their foods come from, everything from seed to the reuse of produce back into our garden spaces. What this grant has done for us is allowed us to hire youth anywhere from junior high to college to work in this field, in their immediate environment. One of them is actually in the room with me, Jesus Perez. He's been a part of Youth Farm since he was 9 years old. this is a 25-year-old organization, grassroots, and he has a baby that's going to be a youth farmer in a couple of years. Most of them are in college, second, third year in college now. And I'm currently focused in North Minneapolis at Nellie Stone Johnson Elementary School, where we grow produce for the school cafeteria program. And this is what this bill allows us to do in our immediate environment, to try to connect our communities to, healthy foods and active living, education and that stuff, and try to get them involved in the discussion around their own sense of personal safety and health and wellness.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. I want to thank Representative Vang for bringing this forward and thank the testifiers for your work, too. It's inspiring hearing you speak. You're obviously thinking very creatively about how to do this work and thinking about community development and economic development as you're developing local food systems. And so I think there's tremendous promise in that, and this is very important for us to support. So I just want to thank you for this and express my support for this measure.
Awesome. Thank you, sir.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the second time around a funding request for this program, and Chair Hamilton carried it in the last biennium. I believe the allocation last time was a total of $500,000. Was that all allocated? What's the history of the program dating back to last biennium?
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. I'm not sure if we have somebody who's been able to answer that. If we want to bring down the department, if we'll just add another chair there if we can. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Chesseth. If you'll introduce yourself, and then we'll have you see about answering that question.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Chesseth, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I don't think we're going to need another chair because I do not have the answer to that question at this time, but I can certainly provide the committee with a full accounting of that program.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Vang. I'm listening to this. This is a great program and a wonderful way to teach students how, you know, where their food comes from. But the one thing I didn't hear about was, obviously, we have a winter, and there's ways to preserve that food that is grown. Wondering, do you do any education in that vein of showing them how to preserve it for long term?
Yeah. So programming for us is the full circle of the food system. A huge part of it is preserving food. We run a series of cooking program with youth, and part of those programs involve like canning and long-term storage of the produce we've grown in the garden. A lot of people tend to live in the winter off of things that we prep in the summer, so that we're approaching the season based on our needs. And the goal is to actually add fresh, locally grown produce to the things that we purchase from Cup Foods or from a food shelf or you're getting from the free places. It's trying to educate people on how to combine the two worlds. We do. I don't know if that answered your question.
And Ms. Ulysses also came to the table. She might have an answer as well. Thank you, Mr. Carr.
Yes, so part of, to what Marcus's point is that we do with the youth is we try to make sure that they understand the life cycle of their food system. Having a conversation around, this is a seed, it turns into a plant, it turns into a piece of food, but what happens when you don't eat it? So having conversations about food waste in general, so what does that look like? How much food do we waste on average? Where does it go when you don't eat it? A lot of times, you know, you give a 14-year-old Brussels sprouts, they've never had it before, you know, they may not love it at first taste. But having conversations around what happens to those Brussels sprouts that you don't like, right? Are there options? And we are a part of a coalition called Northside Fresh that I manage at Appetite for Change, and we have over 50 partners that do a variety of different works. We have individuals that compost and they can and they preserve. And having conversations with those coalition partners, with the youth, on what that looks like. But also having conversations around what you can do to the produce. If you're unsure, can you put it into a soup? Can you dry it? And the Appetite for Change youth over this past summer had the opportunity to try their hand at drying some herbs. So we have sage downstairs and oregano from our gardens that they dried up, they bound, and they hung across in our urban agriculture office space. And so being able to start and having those conversations around the full life cycle of food, where waste comes from, how we can reduce waste, and also use preservation as a means of having something to do with food after it's kind of reached its prime. But we're also piloting a program, not a program, but a potential project in collaboration with the city of Minneapolis to try our hand at deep winter greenhouses. So we will be exploring the opportunity to possibly construct a deep winter greenhouse on one of our urban farm spaces this year. And it's something that from a municipal ordinance perspective is not currently allowed. They technically don't want permanent long-term growing structures into the winter, but they have been working with us to be able to identify and do their city-like sleuthing to assess the causes and possible risks, and hopefully we'll be able to see an ordinance change that will allow those that are growing in spaces to look at deep winter greenhouses as a means of season extension and then go into preservation into the winter time.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any other anyone in the audience that wanted to testify in support or in opposition? Yes, please come to the table and welcome to the committee.
Good day, everyone.
And state your name and provide
my name is
one.
Michael Chang. I'm with a nonprofit called Project Sweetie Pie. I was actually the person that brought this bill forward 4 years ago to Karen Clark. Oftentimes we think that these programs working with youth are strictly about growing food sovereignty, food access. But this whole conversation is much broader than that. The youth are the future. They will be the people that will be replacing each and every one of you, in all of us in this room. And so really what we're doing is we're creating pathways to higher education. We're creating pathways to prosperity. When Representative Hamilton asked us, should we just do a pilot project in North Minneapolis and maybe St. Paul? We said no, and we were adamant about that because we realized that if we were going to maintain our position in this nation as a food provider, that we had to create some innovative ways to make sure that the next generations of farmers are moving forward. And so this project is part of that, and this money was dispensed across the whole state of Minnesota in populations of 10,000 or more. But even more broader than that is that currently I'm working with a group of people in the Upper Harbor Terminal, and we say instead of 40 acres and a mule, let's do 48 acres and a school, framed around food and urban farming, art and culture, historical preservation, and all things ecological. And so the work that we've done has really not only educated the young people in our state, but it's really taken the blinders off of the eyes of the education system and many of the commissioners in this state to realize that our heritage here is based on agriculture. And if we want to maintain that, we can't just maintain the status quo, but we've got to broaden the access to all of these young people. So by and large, the work that we've been doing, Project Sweetie Pie, started off with food access, food sovereignty. But we're working in a much bigger wheelhouse now, and that's building the green infrastructure and building green jobs, because we realize that food and agriculture is the on-ramp, the gateway drug to a strong economy, a strong workforce, and a strong vision for our state. So I would urge each and every one of you to support this cutting-edge legislation and move forward so that we can maintain our strength in terms of being leaders in the ag space.
Thank you, Mr. Chang.
Thank you for your support. We actually were one of the recipients of the Agri Grant, and we're moving to put in place this food hub in the Upper Harbor, working with United Properties, working with Thor Construction and Dana Frank's First Avenue. We're going to create a 2.5-acre year-round food program where we can maintain year-round growing and all of these great ideas, and bring the universities and local schools and park and recreation, so it's a confluence of all these thought leaders so that we can build a stronger Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that testimony. Any other people in the audience? Otherwise, thank you, Representative Vang. You want to provide some concluding comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is a good bill, and I renew my motion.
Thank you very much, Representative Vang. So House File 2344 is laid over. All right, so we'll move on to the next bill, which is House File 1608. Representative Brand. The bill is in your packets. All right, Representative Brand, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1608 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Ag Finance Bill.
Thank you. Please present your bill and introduce your witness.
So House File 1608 is an appropriation of $311,000 in fiscal year 2020 and 2021 for the Center for Rural Policy and Development. There are some deed grants that are going to expire at the end of this fiscal year, and also there I included in that amount, so that was $161,000, and then also an extra $150,000 for expansion to get more researchers to provide more research about what's going on in rural and greater Minnesota. And so with me today, I have Julie Tesh, which is the Executive Director of the Center for Rural Policy and Development, and I'll let her provide her presentation today.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Tesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Julie Tesh, and I am the President and CEO of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. And we do have a brief presentation and also a packet, I believe, for you as well. So a little bit about us. We were actually created in 1997 by the legislature and to come together as kind of a think tank for rural policy. And we've been very successful in doing that. Oops, we have a little timing issue. We are based in Greater Minnesota, and we serve Greater Minnesota. And so myself, I am based in rural Waseca County. I have two researchers. One is in Mankato, and one is in New London. And so all we do is research on Greater Minnesota to provide back to all of you who are decision makers, and we get your thoughts as well. Again, we're nonpartisan. We're a nonprofit. We have 17 board members. Representative Lippert is a brand new board member on our board recently. And then we have three staff members, like I said. And all of our board members are, or I should say, the majority of our board members are appointed by the governor's office. You can see here what we do. We take the complicated and complex issues and problems across Minnesota and try and make them more palatable and meaning and relevant for all of you. And so our researchers will go and aggregate a lot of information and make it a lot easier for you to look at and make policy decisions. We do not make policy recommendations or decisions. We provide you with the accurate, non-biased, non-partisan information for you to do that. Every year we do a State of Rural, and that just came out this past in the past month, and we update that every year. And so you can go on our website on ruralmn.org and check that out. But the three things that I don't think will be surprising to any of you is that population growth is slowing throughout Minnesota, while counties with either non-white populations are located in recreational-type areas like the Lakes region are expected to grow. Our economic vitality, no surprise here that the gap in earnings between rural and urban continues to grow, but there's good news in that the wages for open jobs are growing in Greater Minnesota, so they are playing catch up. And then also in agriculture, we see that land values are still historically high, but obviously average farm income is almost historically low. Something along with our rural State of Rural is we do a rural atlas, and I encourage each of you to go online because you're going to be able to take, it's an interactive collection of maps, so you're going to be able to go online and look at your county, your district, your region, and compare yourself to other counties around the state and other regions. And so you can do it by economic region, by any region that you like, but you can look at demographic information, you can look at economic development information. If you're a data person and you really, really want to get down to the nitty-gritty of who's in your district, I encourage you to go and look at this. This is I have wonderful, wonderful researchers who put this together. So I know that we often talk about the divide between rural and urban, but we do have a lot of things in common, and that's what I want to focus on. We both have an aging population, obviously. We have an aging population, and it's just expected to continue to do that. And some regions are aging faster than others in Greater Minnesota. Another thing that ties us together is the lack of child care. The main difference, though, is that in the metro there's a shortage of affordable child care, and in the rural areas there's a simple shortage of any child care. And that is a study that we're working on right now and will hopefully have to you in the next couple weeks. Of course, there are the things that separate us, and income is one of them. Rural communities do tend to lag behind in the counties in income. It affects the resources and the tax base. And, of course, western and southern counties can especially be affected by the volatile ag industry. And having recently moved back to rural Minnesota, the cost of living is less, but I will tell you that you drive a lot further to get to where you're going. So it does equal out. And actually, one of the studies we're going to be doing here later in this session is an actual cost analysis of, is it less expensive to live in greater Minnesota than in a metro area? So be looking for that here in the later part of session. And then also the thing that separates us is distance and low population density. Distance and low population density make things more difficult and more expensive to do. When we're talking about roads and bridges, that's what it is. It's a lot more distance. And it also makes greater Minnesota issues less viable as a result and harder to understand because there's just so much ground to literally cover. What we work to communicate is helping everyone, all legislators, not just rural legislators, but everyone, all legislators, county commissioners, anyone, is that to help understand the landscape of your area and understand the landscape of greater Minnesota. So each community is unique, we know that, and shaped by its average age and mix of races and backgrounds and industries and attitude. And the problems that we have in rural Minnesota have causes and solutions that are different. I know that we like to find a silver bullet to find to be as efficient as possible, but a lot of times that's not the case because our greater Minnesota communities are so unique. And so they each have their own plan, and that's what we work to communicate. In the next couple weeks, you're going to be receiving a thought leader survey. We put our research agenda together by the recommendations from all of you and from all of your colleagues in the legislature, and then also from other thought leaders across the state. So we survey about 2,000 thought leaders, and we will be asking you to rank in the order that you view is important in your district. And so we'll give you about 15 to 20 questions or ideas that we have that we're seeing as important, and we'll ask you to rank those, and then our research committee will look at that and develop our thought leader survey for the next year. So we greatly value and rely upon your input on that. So like I said, you'll be seeing that here in the next couple weeks, and I'll make sure that you all get copies, as I know Representative Brand will as well. But like I said, that is how we frame our research for the year. And really, we're about building bridges. Again, we talk about the divide. I like to look at it as we have a lot more in common than we do different. What we do for our research is we talk to the rural experts. We go and find them and the people dealing with those issues every single day. We gather information through original research that we conduct. We also work with state and federal data and do a lot of interviews and focus groups. And then we also think hard about the best way to present the information. I'm encouraging my staff to do a lot more with infographics and one-page documents to make things easier for you all to look at, and to putting more things online so that you can play with those things a little bit more. And then we come and talk to the legislators and the state officials and policymakers. You know, my researchers, their favorite thing to do besides doing research is coming and talking to all of you about the research. They get really, really, really excited about research and telling you all about your areas of the state. And we try to have real conversations. You know, we're nonpartisan, we're non-biased. We will give you the information, we'll give you the data that's there. And like I said before, we don't present solutions. We give you the data and the information to help you make those decisions. Just to go over briefly this year's research, we just released part two last week of our finding workers, talking about job vacancies and recruitment in rural Minnesota. We will be having three and four coming out here in the coming weeks. We also had a very good response to our addiction crisis, our opioid crisis paper. We're talking about workforce shortage and then talking about enrollment trends in Minnesota and schools. Our upcoming research, talking about healthcare, our workforce again, the intersection of mental health and local government, that's in the future, and then school funding, and then, like I said before, the cost of living in greater Minnesota. So we have a very full agenda. I just started 5 months ago, and I've I've hit the ground running, and I've encouraged my staff to hit the ground running and getting all of this information out as well. So again, we're about building bridges and getting that access and information to all of you, because when we work, you know, to cut through the noise and dispel, you know, I think we really are more alike than different. As you can see here, you have, you know, Minneapolis here with the spoon and cherry, and then you have Garrison, Minnesota. Minnesotans all love their great big statues of you never know what. And so I think there's a lot more that bridge us together. So with that, I thank you very much, Madam Chair and the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Tesh. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick couple questions. I'll just kind of combine them all because they
Perfect.
All have sort of the same.
Yes.
Ms. Tesh, thank you for coming here, and thank you for the work that you do. You mentioned 17 board members, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
How many of those board members represent counties outside the seven-county metro area, and how many counties mm-hmm. are represented in that board of 17?
Ms. Tesh.
Madam Chair, Representative Miller, the only committee members or board members that are within the seven-county metro area, gosh, Representative Kiffmeyer is about it, or Senator Kiffmeyer, and I don't even know if she's in that seven-county. All of our board members are greater Minnesota. I can't give you an exact specific county count, but we try to have all of the state represented, and we have some board seats available right now, and I'm working very hard on getting more northern Minnesota seats available. We do have quite a few southern and central, but all of our board members are greater Minnesota.
Representative Miller.
Well, Madam Chair, we do have someone from Roseau in here today. Maybe you could talk to him after that. I'm sure that he doesn't have enough to do already. So,
hey, busy people, let's get that's things right. done.
That's it.
Ms. Tesh. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Tesh, we really appreciate the great work the center does. And if you'd let staff and board know that, that'd be greatly appreciated. My question is around funding. Your current funding sources, what, if any, other state funds do you receive, funding from foundations or from private contributions?
Thank you. Ms.
Madam
Beth.
Chair, Representative Hamilton, our funding is, we have our appropriation in agriculture, and then we also do have some base funding indeed. We did receive some one-time grant funding last session, and obviously that's one-time funding, and that is expiring. We also do receive funding from the McKnight Foundation and also a small grant from the Blandin Foundation, and that is how we are funded.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some very interesting topics on your discussion list, and I have to ask, is there a mailing list you send these out to, or do you have to go online and request these to have access to some of this research?
Ms. Tesh.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I'll give you two answers to that. All of you around the table are on our mailing list. You should be receiving our research. If you aren't, please let me know. And number two, if you have a personal email address or for anyone in the audience, you can go on our website and sign up as well for our news alerts and our research.
Thank you, Ms. Tesh. Are we getting it in hard copy or in email version when we're on the list?
Madam Chair, you are getting it in email, and I believe our board chairs were delivering things to you hard copy. So our latest, gosh, our workforce last week, we delivered hard copies to the chairs. But if you would like a hard copy, if you prefer that, please let me know. We are happy to do that and happy to get that to you, whatever is more palatable for you to get you to read it.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And following up on Representative Hamilton's question, I pulled up your website and I mm-hmm. see you've got the 990 form there, but mm-hmm. I think it would be good if you receive public funding to thank the people of Minnesota and maybe note that somewhere in your how much you receive and where it comes from with appropriations from the general fund, because it's a little hard to find in 35 pages of financial statement.
All right.
Madam Chair, happy to do that. That I completely agree with you. That is a very good recommendation. Thank you.
I have a question. So you're coming before us to get an increase on the ag side, or you're also doing the same on the deed side?
We are putting in a request for grants over on the deed side as well.
All right. Any other questions? Any other testifiers? Anybody
from the audience who wants to speak in opposition and support? Seeing none, all right, Representative Brand.
Thank you for hearing the bill 1608 today. I just wanted to end by talking a little bit about my interactions with the rural policy folks over the years. And so as a former city council member in St. Peter, I was able to get a hands-on approach, so to speak, because they were once a tenant of the community center. So I got to know who they were a little bit, and then I got to dive into their website and figure out a whole bunch of stuff. Now as a legislator, I get to get the benefit also of learning about what's going on in rural Minnesota. And so I just want to bring to your attention this document that they published called Letters to the Governor, to the new governor, I should say. And so this is targeted towards Governor Walz, but also it's also useful information for all of us in this room, all of us in the legislature. And we talk about demographics, it talks about immigration, it talks about employment growth, it talks about the environment, infrastructure, health care. There's a good article on health care. It talks about the complex map of substance abuse in Minnesota, written by one of my constituents at the Minnesota State University Mankato. And also at the end there, the last, the closer is child care. And there's a good primer in there about child care in Minnesota. And so as we're talking about ways that we can work in a bipartisan way, it's good to have good information that we can use. And I really appreciate the fact that this resource is available for all of us to help make the decisions we need to make. So thank you
Representative Brand. So House File 1608 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus hank finance bill. Okay. Very good. Thank you. All right. We're going to bring down now Representative Fabian and Representative Grassel. No, Representative Green. Oh, got it. Okay. So my apologies for stating the wrong name. So I didn't have the notes updated.
That's quite all right, Madam Chair.
So, welcome to the committee, and I think we're going to have you kind of co-present because the bills are nearly identical. They're under the same topic. But I believe that we also will have Representative Hamilton move the two.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 857 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Ag Finance Bill. And you want me to go ahead and move the other one as well, Madam Chair?
Okay, so now I know why I'm confused. So Representative Fabian and Representative Grassel, and he's not coming. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, he's been out sick for the last few days, and he asked me if I would carry his House File 93.
Got it.
But if you want to move my bill first, I would be very glad to do that, too.
Oh. Let's stick with these two to begin with. So these are the 18 and 93, and I believe that's what Representative Hamilton just did.
I just moved 857. You want me to withdraw that?
Yeah, withdraw that one.
Withdraw that motion, and I will move House File 18 and House File 93?
Please, right? Yes.
For possible inclusion in the Omnibus Ag Finance Bill.
Thank you. And so these are the wolf elk depredation funding bills. So we'll put those first, and then we'll get to wild turkeys after that. Okay. Representative Fabian, welcome to the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 18 to the committee. Representative Miller mentioned Roseau. Yes, I do. I live in Roseau, and the reason that I have both the elk and the wolf depredation payments in House File 18 is because I think I'm probably the only legislator that has both elk and wolf depredation claims in the district that I represent. So that's why I combined them into the one. And that, members, you can see that the appropriation is left blank. Department of Ag has got some information. I hope that they have that in your packets. You can see that the bottom line, if you have that, there's a little spreadsheet that they have the information there for, excuse me, fiscal year 19 at the very bottom. They don't have the information yet for fiscal 20. When, Madam Chair, when you get to the point to where numbers need to be plugged in there, I'd be happy to work with you and Ag and the rest of the members of the committee to come up with the right number. So if I could just real quickly, the first part of the bill, Section 1, Paragraph A, that just has to do with the livestock that are destroyed or crippled by wolves. It also allows for up to $5,000 to be transferred or reimbursed expenses that would be incurred by University of Minnesota Extension agents that would go out and do the adjustments on these claims. And then also in paragraph B, that's the elk damage that's there, and that's both for crop and fence damage. If a herd of elk decides to run through a barbed wire fence, they run through the barbed wire fence. They don't go over it. So a lot of producers spend a lot of time repairing fences that have been torn down. And then paragraph C just simply allows for a transfer of funds between the two accounts, between the elk depredation account and the wolf depredation account, so that if one needs to be propped up a little bit, it just provides the flexibility to be able to do that. That's the main part of the bill. If anybody has any questions about the damage that wolves do, I've got some fairly graphic photographs here. If someone wants to see those, they're available for you. I do also want to say that one of the things, and this is kind of off topic a little bit, but one of the concerns that a lot of producers have with regards to the wolf depredation claims is that in order to pay a claim, you have to find the parts, a carcass. And quite frankly, oftentimes, a young calf, you don't find anything. And when the cow is standing in the pasture, mallowing, you know that that calf is gone, okay? And so one of the weaknesses that we have is that they require finding something, and I understand that we do need to do that, but I also have received some concerns from producers where they also then have to find sign of the wolves as well, and if it's late in the summer, it's the dry season, it's really hard to find tracks in the hard ground if there's mud and so forth around. That's easy to find. So there are still a few things that I would like to see us try to work on as a legislature, working with the DNR and the Extension Services. So I'll turn it over to Representative Green for his bill and the first questions. I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Let's just interrupt for a moment. We've got a couple of questions. So Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, just a couple comments to follow up on what Representative Fabian said. There's a couple of major time frames where we get into problems with wolves, and obviously spring and the calving season, unless you got a real heavy snowpack, the wolves are pretty hungry, and they'll obviously go and take the path of least resistance. The one that's even actually more problematic is what Representative Fabian mentions later, late in summer, you've got puppy wolves that they're training to hunt, and you don't have snow. It's very difficult to, find tracks in a dry pasture, that type of thing. And I can just tell you from personal experience, if you don't locate a carcass literally within 24 hours, there'll be none left. You may be able to find some splinters of a skull or something like that on a smaller calf. They literally will consume that because if you stop and think about it, a 90-pound calf, 85-pound calf, you've got 4, 6, 7, sometimes 8 wolves. It's just literally gone. The other thing to think about here, if you look at this spreadsheet, you'll see this stuff goes up and down. There's a couple reasons for that. What happens in that depredation situation, Mother Nature plays a huge role in that. If the circumstance is that it's easier for wolves to prey on deer, they'll do that. But that's really controlled by Mother Nature and a lot of other things that are completely out of agriculture's realm. The other thing is, and you'll see these costs, they look like they go up and down. We see some pretty huge swings in the price of livestock, from year to year. And so when things are looking good, instead of losing a $600 calf, 2 years down the road, that might be $1,100 calf. It's very important that we keep this these dollars in here. Because looking forward, you can't predict how this is going to work. Mother Nature can be kind, and she can be very brutal. The other thing is it happens if we end up in a situation where we run out of money before we get to the end of the biennium. Then you've got producers that are sitting there with thousands and thousands of dollars worth of damage they can't be reimbursed for till we come around to the next cycle, and I've seen that happen, turn into a real train wreck. So this is a very important situation. It's a cross we bear in the state of Minnesota because we're not directly able to manage wolves because of the federal protection.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a good segue into my quick question. So thanks, Representative Fabian Green. I certainly support this. What is the current status on hunting wolves, and what is the discussion that you're hearing coming down over, we'll say, the next year?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, ma'am. The legal status or no?
Yeah, the legal status.
I'm just kidding. Right now, last I've heard, I believe it's the Department of the Interior is working through an administrative rule to delist the wolves so that Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan would retain management jurisdiction over wolves just like they do in, I believe, Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho. I think I've got that right.
Madam Chair, just a real quick, so I have an understanding of it, what does that look like? Let's say they were delisted. What's the common hunting practices? When? How many? Just what does that look like?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We do currently have statute language in statute through the Department of Natural Resources to establish a hunting season. And the DNR has the rulemaking authority to establish the season, you know, the parameters, trapping, hunting, the number of wolves and so forth that would be taken. In the past, when they've done that, they've established a number, I'll just say 225. And they keep track. You have to report them every two. I have a wolf pelt in my, I didn't bring it down. I have a wolf pelt in my office. I trapped one in 2012. And you had to report it within 24 hours. You had to go to the local wildlife management. We went to the wildlife management area and talked to the staffer there, and they entered all the data and so forth so that there's a continuous updating of the data each day. And when they get to a point to where they can anticipate we're going to reach this number of 225 by Friday, they announce on Wednesday that the season will be closed at midnight on Friday or whatever. That's in a nutshell, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We're going to let Representative Green now present House File 93, which is the Grassl Bill.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And the House File 93... Excuse me, I'll be going next. House Bill 93 actually takes last year's appropriations and just puts them into the new bill. And so it's $175,000 for each year. But unlike Representative Fabian's, mine deals with wolf depredation and livestock. And then this one also gives the $5,000 from the commissioner to the university to provide a fair market value for destroyed or crippled livestock. And Madam Speaker, the bill speaks for itself, and I think that Representative Fabian covered most of everything else, and I'd just be redundant. But I will say that in our district, although we don't have elk, we have overabundance of wolves. And I will tell you that as a general rule, if you can see wolves in the middle of the day, you really have a problem. And it was probably about two, maybe 3 years ago now, I actually saw a full-grown wolf dragging a full-grown cow. And so these are big, powerful animals. And, you know, you take a 900 to 1,200-pound cow, and if a wolf can drag it, it's serious, can do some serious damage. And Representative Fabian is absolutely right. You do not find most of these animals unless you can catch them in the middle of of killing it. A great deal of the time, they'll just carry it off. And so... It's a huge problem for us, so I will stand for questions.
Thank you. Are there any other questions by committee members? Anyone in the audience that wants to testify for or against either of these bills, House File 18 and House File 93? Seeing none, then Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chair, I renew my motion that House File 18 and House File 93 be held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Ag Finance Bill.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Thank you to both of you for coming and presenting the bills. And we are going to have Representative Green stay to do his own bill then next.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I might add that the Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, and the Cattlemen's Association strongly support what we're trying to do with this.
Thank you. I apologize. I didn't give you opportunity for closing comments. Appreciate that. Representative Green, so we're going to switch gears a little bit, wild turkeys, then we'll get back to Representative Tapke. He's going to talk a little bit more about a different proposal. So wild turkey depredation. So Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chair, I'll move House File 857 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Ag Finance Bill.
All right, Representative Green.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. House File 857 was brought to me by constituents. You should have their letters. I can read the letters, Madam Speaker, but with my voice the way it is, and you have them in front of you, if you'd like me to read their statements, I will. Do you have them, I should ask? Mm-hmm. Okay. And those letters go on to tell that...
Go ahead. Sorry, Mr.
Okay, no. And those letters go on to tell you the problems that at least two people in my district are having. The one has a buffalo farm he has had for 37 years. And the pictures that he sent were very low quality, so I don't know if you can see them, but they are amongst his buffalo in the feeding troughs and around the area. And so he's not only concerned with the amount of feed they eat, and they eat a tremendous amount of feed. These are big birds. And when you've got over 36 of them picking at your food for your livestock, it's serious. And with the amount of snow that we've had up there, I believe this year is probably even a little worse. But they're also concerned, both him and the dairy farmer that sent the letter, with the droppings and the salmonella and the other diseases that come with droppings. And I know maybe in the metro area you guys probably see some of that if you go places where there's a lot of geese. Well, it's pretty disgusting, and you don't want to be feeding your animals in those areas. And so this is what brought the bill forward. And what the bill does, it for the most part just copies the language in the depredation for other animals, but it does add in subdivision 4 that payments that if this bill should go through, that payments that you receive from any insurance would have to be deducted. And subdivision 5, if the commissioner finds that the landowner has shown damage or destruction of the owner's crop or damage to the, or destruction to a feedlot or feedstock, feed was caused more probably than not by wild turkeys, the commissioner shall pay compensation. But this bill goes a little further, and it's going to be contentious, I know. But these guys feel they're up against the wall. And in 2.19, it says that the owner is eligible for compensation. An owner who is eligible for compensation under this section may, when funds are unavailable for authorized payments under this section, take wild turkeys on the owner's land at the owner's discretion in a manner allowed. Now, I did get a question on 97B.655 that turkeys isn't in there. But when I put the bill together, I assumed that this bill was putting turkeys in there. So if that's wrong, I'll need to know that. But the rest of the bill, it's kind of self-explanatory. It talks about legal action that can be taken if claims are denied. But, Madam Speaker, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Green. Sorry, we're scurrying here. We're missing the second page of your bill. I think it was assumed that we had it on the back side, and we didn't. So we'll be getting the second page to people. So I apologize for that.
Well, there is actually three pages, and on the third page, then it does talk about the appropriations. And like Representative Fabian's bill, my intent was to put these in with other depredations, so when those numbers are figured in, that's where this money would come from.
Thank you. And then we do have questions. Representative Wazwick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Green, I'm wondering if you have any information about any sort of estimates on how much damage or how many farmers are impacted by this specific issue at all?
In my district, in Lower Clearwater County, where these complaints come from, there was actually four people that had come to me. You only have testimony from two. I would have liked them to come down and testify for themselves, but with the snow that we have, and it's also coming into calving season, they did not feel they could come, drive 10 hours, round trip to get here. So as far as the numbers yet, No, we don't. That would be calculated, I would assume, should this bill pass, and then they would have to prove that there was depredation, and with pictures and, you know, receipts and whatever. So,
thank you. Representative Anderson, next.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Green, I support your bill and was wondering if you would accept a friendly amendment at some point to include depredation by geese in your bill. Where I live, if you have soybeans along any kind of a wetland or a slough, the soybeans come up a couple inches tall and the geese come out there and wipe out acres of soybeans, and then weeds grow up and kind of ruin the field. So I support what you're trying to do, but I would talk to you offline and see if we could add depredation by geese as well.
Representative Green.
Madam Speaker, Representative Anderson, yeah, I would certainly be open to that. I know that there is a huge problem with geese, not just in the farmland, although it is, you know, I don't really think people realize how much these birds eat. They're big birds. I would be happy to talk about that.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Green. I really appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair, for also allowing me to speak here. I had a couple of questions, and maybe the department is better suited for these questions, but I support your bill because I do want to see wild turkeys in Minnesota. Obviously, at one point, there were none because of hunting and that sort of thing, but I'm glad to see that they're coming back. And I want to make sure that we are also allowing for the fact that we've got folks that are being impacted by those populations going back. And so I do appreciate this bill. I think it's a good way to kind of be the cushion between the two opposing forces there. My first question is, how much does a turkey eat? It can't be that much. I mean, are we talking tens of thousands of dollars maybe at most? Or
Representative Green.
Madam Speaker and Representative Brand, a turkey can eat a lot. A chicken can eat a lot if you're feeding chickens. I mean, a chicken obviously isn't the same, but the birds, the females are 25 pounds. The males can get over 40 pounds. That's a big bird. And they can suck up a lot of feed, especially ground feed or corn. And so I think that there is a real concern on the part of the ranchers. But I also don't want to let slide again the fact that there could be a health concern with the droppings from the turkeys inside the feedlots. And if you read the letter, you'll see that they're telling us that these turkeys aren't afraid, but they are elusive. I mean, they'll walk right under the feet of the buffalo and into the feedlots. And so, you know, you take 25 to 40-pound turkeys, they can probably raise some heck with your feed. And then on the dairy farmer, it's a little bit harder to read, but because it's handwritten. But they're actually pecking into his silage bales. And once the holes are poked in the silage bales, then it ruins it, and the cat, it'll mold. So.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other question I guess I have, is there any way that there's any grants out there for deterrent, anything that we can do to get these turkeys away from the feeding sites?
Representative.
Or also, could farmers put the feed inside and feed their cattle inside? I know, you know, feed barns, that sort of thing with milking and stuff like that. That's usually when we fed our grain, was when we were milking, and then we just had hay outside for them during the day. Is there any way that they could switch up how they feed their cattle to fix this problem?
Representative Green.
Well, Madam Speaker, Representative Brand, the first thing that comes to mind is that well, yeah, you may feed your dairy cows inside, but your silage is still outside. And, excuse me, if you have a 40 to 50 head of buffalo or cattle, it's not feasible to feed them inside. And I also don't think it would be fair to ask a rancher or a cattleman, whatever his crop is, to build a barn to feed his livestock inside because the DNR planted turkeys. And there is also, you know, the issue that a lot of people don't believe the turkeys are indigenous to this area. They were planted here. And we have other problems with turkeys, too, that this bill doesn't address, and that is if you come up north, you'll have to stop on the road sometimes just to let them cross, and there's a lot of them.
Thank you. That raised a number of issues, I think, and so we're not going to necessarily totally dissect the whole turkey situation.
clearly there's some damage being done. Clearly farmers are being impacted, and we want to make sure that we're attentive to that. So I appreciate Representative Green. I know that we had a Representative Cleburne on the list.
Thank you, Chair Poppe. Representative, my question is about the insurance claims. Oftentimes when you receive an insurance payment and then you receive compensation on top of that from another entity, the insurance company will try to come back and claw some of the payment that they gave you back. So I'm wondering, you talk about this insurance payment being on top of a private insurance, but how do we have a guarantee that the insurance companies won't try to claw some of this money back?
Representative Green.
Madam Speaker, I think Representative, it says just the opposite. It says that if you're getting an insurance payment, that has to be deducted from any depredation claims that you receive. And so, you know, all I would say is I'd like to believe that our farmers and ranchers are honest. And you know, I'm not accusing, but I'm just saying that's where that would be weeded out. And if there is an insurance claim, then and the insurance is paid and then the depredation payment comes, well, then the insurance company is entitled to get some of that money back. So it's or the depredation would be lowered to match the insurance claim, one or the other. If that makes sense.
Representative Cleburne.
I just want to ask for clarification of the last statement. Thank you. Okay, so you're saying the insurance company could ask for some of this payment money?
Well, I suppose they could if they had overpaid, like anyone that overpaid. But I think, Madam Chair, I think that the idea is that if there's an insurance claim put in and it's paid, your depredation payment would be lowered by that amount. So there wouldn't be a double payment.
Thank you. Representative Cleburne?
I understand that, and I think I'm not being clear in my question, so I apologize to you, Representative, for that. What I'm saying is insurance company A pays farmer for the claim. Everybody's above board. I'm not saying anyone's being dishonest here. Farmer now claims that they have a claim above the cost that the insurance company paid, so they apply to the commissioner for that difference, the delta, in what the value is and what they're paid by the insurance company. They submit a claim. Legally, everything's above board. They are paid their claim. Now insurance company comes back to farmer and says, hey, wait a minute. We already reimbursed you for that claim. We want our money back if somebody else has paid you. That's the clawback that I'm asking about.
Okay.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That does clarify that. I would say that if it's not clear in the bill, then we can work on that. But I think that, let's say, if you were the rancher and you had, for instance, a $1,500 claim and your insurance company paid $1,000, he's obviously has not paid the full amount of that claim.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have an extra $500 that you turn in for depredation, I don't see how the insurance company could legally come after that $500. But that would be, that's for lawyers, I guess.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that we would need to add some language in this that would say it's not attachable somehow by the insurance companies. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. You must have read my thoughts there. Yeah, to me, they would work together and come up with a total claim amount, with what Representative Green mentioned, and if it's $1,000, the insurance would pay X amount, and this damage claim would come on top of that. So with crop insurance, same type of thing. There's a total damage amount arrived at, and then that's divided up between the parties.
I know we had Representative Keel on the list. Did you want to respond from previous comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I guess there are a lot of things that I was going to comment on or have been clarified, but I would like to make the point also that these animals, first the turkeys, are not indigenous to Minnesota. I believe they were planted by DNR. They're fun to see. They're very aggressive. And one thing I think people need to realize is when you have those kinds of flocks in rural Minnesota, or anywhere, actually, they leave large amounts of droppings. And I'm not in any way stretching the imagination. And the disease that Representative Green talked about is very real, and they can cause quite a bit of damage and cost. So I just want to make that point that this is a serious issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions by committee members? Otherwise, Representative Lewick?
I just wanted to reiterate the disease issue. When you're feeding cattle, particularly ground feed or supplements, and you have any type of birds involved, you are really, really putting your livestock at risk. And and that goes for geese, too. I know we have issues with that, where geese come up in a pasture. And, I mean, you can lose your entire calf crop overnight if you get the wrong thing in there. And so that alone, completely independent of the damage, the risk that takes, I mean, you simply don't want to tolerate that in the livestock feed. I mean, the other thing in a comment about it's just radically different. In fact, one of the most dangerous things you can do with animals that are acclimated to be fed outside in the winter is put them inside, because you'll have another train wreck on your hands of very sick animals very quickly. So depending on what type of operation you're running, it's standard procedure to feed livestock outside and not house them except in extreme circumstances. Completely different. I grew up on a dairy farm, and our cows never got out except for a sunny day in the middle of winter, in the wintertime. But on a beef operation, you really head for trouble if you start trying to shelter them in the dead of winter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we have someone from DNR who would like to come forward and be able to talk about this issue. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Rivers, Deputy Director for the Division of Fish and Wildlife with the DNR. Turkeys actually are native to Minnesota. Certainly they have expanded beyond their range, which was southeast Minnesota. Some of that has been done by the department through trap and transplant, and also some private individuals have moved birds. We have flocks that have been established in Park Rapids and Two Harbors, not exactly what we consider traditional turkey country, but those have been established by private individuals, as well as potentially in the West, the DNR. In terms of lines 2.19 through 2.21 related to the ability of a landowner to shoot birds in the event of not being compensated for loss, we do work with producers who are having trouble or damage from turkeys through our cooperative damage management agreement. And we work with them so that they can remove birds that are challenged. So I just want to bring that to your attention.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. To the DNR person, do turkeys in Minnesota have any natural predators?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, they do, especially on their nests, predation by all sorts of ground predators such as raccoons and now currently opossums, other things like that. Fox and coyote can certainly take small poults. They are very fecund, they have large clutches, and they do well. So it's a success story, but we're managing through that success.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again. Quick question. Any thought of raising a limit to one permit, one tom? Do you have a target of how many you want to see here in the state, or are you reaching that target?
To the test fire.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we've taken a rather slow, conservative approach to how we've managed turkeys. In the last several years, we have changed that. You don't need to apply for a license for time periods beyond time period C now, and we are looking at ways to liberalize turkey opportunities. We offer opportunities in the fall as well, which is tom or hen birds. So a person can shoot up to two birds per year right now.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate you coming down. Any other test fires? Anyone in the audience who'd like to speak in support or opposition? All right, Representative Green, if you have any closing comments.
I only want to thank you very much, Madam Chair, for hearing my bill. I hope you will consider putting it into the omnibus bill.
Thank you. And Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll renew my motion that House File 857 be held over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, so now we'll move to 1630. And 1630 is Representative Tabke has
that bill, and I believe you might have a testifier as well. So this is a straight-up appropriation. There is an amount being requested. So Representative Tapke, if you'd like to move your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I move the House File 1630 be considered for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Ag Finance Bill.
All right. Please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so this is my first time actually presenting to Ag Committee, so I have treats, and I was tired of bringing donuts, so we have fruit today. I don't know where that went. Oh, it's up here. And so that might either tank my bill or be good. We'll see how that works for everyone. But thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I have House File 1630 is in front of you today. This is a complementary bill to what we just discussed two bills ago with Representative Fabian and House File 18 and Representative Grossel Green, who was presenting it for House File 93. And what this bill is the precursor to the predation bill. So this bill that by no means impacts the predation refunds or anything like that. What this does is help prevent issues from happening between wolves and livestock. And so this is a very good bill. What it would be is $200,000 in fiscal year 2020, $200,000 in fiscal year 2021. And this will be, this money is used in a grant process, and it is used for preventative ways of for reducing the interaction between wolves and livestock. And so we have here today a testifier to talk about how some of those things work in northern Minnesota, where the wolf population is higher. And I would, Madam Chair, like to turn it over to her now.
Hi, I'm Mary Falk. Can everybody hear me okay? Yep. All right. My husband and I farmed a couple hundred acres up north, and half of it is dedicated as a wildlife refuge. It connects to a wildlife corridor that is fed in through the upper St. Croix River. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with wildlife corridors, but that means it's basically a highway where everything follows the water and the predators follow everything else. And we have that going through the middle of our property. We farm cattle and goats and sheep and miscellaneous chickens and a few ducks. And we have not had any predatory issues in over 25 years. And the reason that is that we run livestock guardian dogs. And we're lazy. We're surrounded by wolves. We have coyotes. We have bobcat. We've had cougar on our property. And we have a resident bear. And we just cannot, we like our sleep. We don't like to have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and shoot off a rifle. The guard dogs handle all this for us. And we could never farm where we are without the guard dogs. And the guardian dogs act as traffic control. They just tell the predators, keep on moving. They don't engage. They would if the predators engaged them. But it's against their nature to take on an attack. They'd much rather go where it's easier, like the neighbors. So, in fact, a neighbor that recently moved into us, to our area, called me up and asked me if I had any guard dogs for sale. And he didn't realize he was actually calling me, which was 40 acres to the north of him. And as we're talking, he said, well, wait a minute. You tell me that the dogs will just push the predators off? I said, yeah, they just keep them moving. He said, so it's your dogs that are bringing the bear to my property. I said, that's correct. But they're not on my property. So, the guard dogs do a lot. They not only keep the predators moving, they clean up the messes that the livestock make, such as afterbirth. If something has died, they help remove that too. So when you have a big lambing operation, you have a lot of afterbirth there. I don't mean to, this is right before your lunch and you're eating some fruit. Sorry about that. But it gets messy out there, and the dogs clean it up, and they remove the smell, and that also greatly helps for the predation issues. But the biggest thing about all this is learning about, to be successful with livestock guardian dogs, people also need to learn about the habits of the predators. And the predators are pack animals, as are our guard dogs. And when you disrupt the pack, you disrupt the social setting of these animals, and you can really magnify the problem. And an example, I know some of you have heard this story before, but I'm going to reiterate it. We had our own resident coyote pack, and they did what they're supposed to do. They eat the mice, they eat the rabbits, they keep the voles down, and all the other little rodents on the property, which affect our operation. And we functioned really smoothly with the guard dogs and with the coyotes in tandem for over 20 years until one of the young men down the road decided he wanted to take up coyote hunting as a hobby. And he was so happy that he shot the resident bitch, which is what they're called, and all hell broke loose within 2 weeks of that. Because now you had a pack that was totally unsupervised. It was, imagine you being home and you've got 8 kids and all of a sudden there's no parents and you say, hey kids, I'm going to Europe for 2 weeks. Here's the keys to the car. And that's basically what happened. We had our first attack attempt ever. We weren't expecting it to happen so fast. So we only had 2 of our dogs out on the property where this attack occurred, and they were juveniles. But they kept we had 2 sheep that were attacked, and they prevented the sheep from being killed. Whereas the neighbor a mile down the road that had no guard dogs lost 10 sheep that night. And it took us 6 months to get this pack under control because it was just totally unsupervised. It was gone bonkers. And until before then, my husband would be out on his tractor, and he'd be raking the hay, and we would watch the coyote bitch would come out with her pups and jump the mice that were being turned up by the hay rake. The sheep were 5 acres away with the dogs, and it was symbiotic. It all worked just fine, and we went on like that for 20 years. Obviously, it wasn't the same coyote bitch, but she had taught her pack to respect the boundaries of the dogs, and it just works on like that. But most importantly, the coyotes are cheap guard dogs because they keep other packs of coyotes away. And this is how it works. It's like the ripples on a pond, and they kill their own. There's only one pair allowed to breed in the pack. It's just like the wolves. There's only one pair allowed to breed. If they do get a little randy and they breed out of turn, those pups are killed. And the same thing happens with if you're running a pack of guard dogs, which I found out, unfortunately, the hard way. I had one bitch that bred out of turn, and I didn't protect her in a special kennel, and the alpha bitch killed all those pups really quite quickly. And it was a huge lesson of way things work. They have their own birth control. So when we had hunting for a limited time, we were inundated with wolves. I mean, I did not have any wolf problems, but I was inundated with the phone calls from farmers that had never seen wolves before, but the wolves were driven out of the north down into central and southern Minnesota because they were going away from their packs. They were being dispersed. Like, I'm originally from the West Coast, so I'm going to use the starfish analogy. If we had a bunch of fishermen that used to pull in starfish with their nets, and they hated those starfish because they ate abalone and things like that, so they cut off the legs of the starfish and threw them back in the sea, and a new starfish grew from each leg. So that's kind of what packs do. You disperse the packs, and now you have nobody controlling the birth control, and they all magnify. So what I'm just saying is it's a lot cheaper to prevent a problem than to stop a problem. And guard dogs work not just with wolves. They work with bears. They work with, oh, my gosh, horned owls, which are the most lethal of everything out there. But, in fact, I bet there's a lot of people that have kills that think it's a wolf when it's actually been a horned owl. Because when they come in, they land on a 50-pound lamb with their talons right in the horn buds, and they kill the lamb as they land. And that's, you're done. And it takes a good dog to hear a horned owl coming in to do that. And they'll decimate, you know, free-range chicken operation. But the guard dogs do their diligent duty, once they're aware of what the issue is. But they're not 100%. They do take some training in, and the farmers need some education on how to properly use them. So where they have not been really well received is where you have an operation out west where they have huge amounts and they only run one dog. So when they know that they have more time available or they have more dogs to use properly, it's a lot more effective.
Thank you. Thank you. We're definitely getting an education today. At least
I'm sorry. It's just I get on my little platform. I want to go.
Like
we have cool dogs.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just have one. Deputy.
additional thing to add, thank you, is that this program has been going on for 2 years already. It had a two-year, and as you all have in your packets, there's a sheet here that shows how the program was used in the last 2 years. In 2017-18, there were 53 applications were received, and 24 projects were put out, and that's $120,000 in 2017-18, and then the opposite side has 39 applications were received, and $120,000 also was granted to 23 applicants, and you can see the request versus the granted what was there. So thank you very much.
And I just want to add, on our operation, we don't have any fencing. So we run the livestock with the dogs, and the dogs also manage the livestock.
We have a question. Representative Miller. Nope. Okay, any other questions? Anybody? Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tapke, thank you for carrying this forward into the next biennium. I think it's a great program. I just tell you a real quick story. In the 60s, when I was a farm kid, I had an aunt that lived north of Aiken, and my aunt's name was Myrtle, and she had two donkeys. One was named Mabel and one was named Wilbur. And we always thought they were just pets. And of course, as farm kids, we used to like to climb up on the fence and jump on their backs and ride them around and so on. But, you know, when this came to me a couple of years ago, I realized why she had those donkeys. And she never had, that I'm aware of, even though I was a young kid, she never had any problems with wolves. And she was clearly in the wolf range at that time. So thank you for bringing this forward.
This bill very much also supports donkeys as guard animals, so it's good.
All right. I see no other questions. And Representative Tapke, any closing comments?
No, Madam Chair, thank you very much for this, and I think that using preventative measures is a much better way to keep that predation count available and moving forward. So thank you very much, everyone, for your support, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tapke.
Do I need to renew my motion? Sorry.
The bill will be laid over.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so Representative Hamilton. So now we're going to House File 1136. And I know that Dean Boer is documented testifier here,
right,
as far as if he's coming down. And I know that you have the bill in your packet. There's a letter of support as well in the packet. And so, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know we're limited on time, so I'll keep my comments very brief. House File 1136 increases the funding for the AGREET program that we established here a few years ago. Like you said, Madam Chair, I would like to point your attention, or everybody's attention, to the letter of support. This is the groups, various commodity groups, that actually brought this idea to us a few years ago. And Madam Chair, if you recall, and the members recall, the ag special in the higher ed bill continued to decline. And the intent was to replenish those dollars in the form of a GREET and keep it in control of the Ag Committee versus the higher ed. That way all of us would have access to how those dollars were invested, if you will.
Representative Hamilton, I hate to interrupt you, but just you want to move your bill.
Yes, I'd like to move House File 1136 to be held over for possible inclusion. And so to finish my thought, what the ask here is to replenish the total amount of those dollars that were depleted in the Ag Special. With that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Dean Boer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, I'm Brian Boer. I'm Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Hamilton for introducing HF 1136. And thank the Department of Ag and our farm organization and commodity partners and others who have helped with the history of the AGREET legislation, which was originally put in place in 2015. I also want to recognize that I'm partnering with the University of Minnesota Extension and College of Veterinary Medicine are part of this as well as they go through this. Simply put, AGREET has been game-changing legislation that places Minnesota at the forefront of innovation and growing agricultural productivity, as it says in the original bill, and sustainably improving global competitiveness of Minnesota's agricultural economy. AGREET does this by investing in personnel, facilities, and other infrastructure at the University of Minnesota in a responsive way that meets the needs of Minnesota's agriculture through an advisory group. With funding allocated since 2015, and when it was first introduced, we've hired and have in process, I think I testified this about earlier in the session, about 21 faculty and CFANs, College of Veterinary Medicine, and Extension educators. And these included, for just a few of those areas, very broad areas from crop systems, which is what the position is defined after, to agricultural climatology, turkey physiology, soil fertility and health, and forest biometrics. So a very broad array example of that. And in some cases, we've also, and we just recently investing in crop breeding positions related to Forever Green, which the committee has also listened to in support of developing those programs. The positions simply would not have existed without AGREET, and they're placing us at the forefront of competing for grants. As I said last time, many universities around the country are reducing, and states are reducing their funding broadly to universities, not simply to agriculture. And so this has placed us in a really strong competitive position relative to competing for those grants as well. And we've seen faculty already competing and engaging and receiving those grants. An example, just a quick example, Melissa Wilson is a faculty member who's in soil water climate. She works in precision application of animal manure in crop systems. And I raised that one because that's a place where we have a faculty member who's in, and we've tried to do this across all these positions because none of these challenges are single point challenges. They go across soils to animals, to crops, and it's all linked together. She works on how we take animal manure for crops to improve soil health and soil fertility and reduce reliances on chemical crop nutrient management. So it's really become a system of looking how do we precision apply. Another faculty member, Jolene Hadrich, is an ag economist working in the areas of dairy management. And, of course, in today's environment where there's challenges for dairy farmers, addressing those needs. And she has an extension appointment, as does Melissa Wilson as well. So they take that information out to farmers who are using that. We've also briefly supported over two dozen grad students, which I think is important because that's another area that funding grad students, we often have to fund their research and their as well as their stipends for living because they're postgraduate students. And that's developing the next generation of scientists and scholars to move this forward as well. So these investments have long-term reach in terms of not only our faculty, but in the future generation who are studying with those faculty. We've invested in lab and research infrastructure, for example, our soil testing lab, which serves all of Minnesota, and in rapid response funds for some of these issues people are talking about today. They're often short-term. They need immediate response. The University of Minnesota Extension has capacity to address those quickly. This helps to direct those funds to researchers who can do that work, get the funding on the ground to be able to pursue it very rapidly. So we've addressed issues of resistance management in soybean aphids, in poultry or avian flu detection through the Wilmer facility that was invested in by the legislature, through the diagnostic lab at the College of Veterinary Medicine. We've done work in food safety interventions with salmonella, which was a recent challenge for the turkey industry. And we're now working in surveillance and control of African swine influenza, which is a significant potential disease for Minnesota. So it's both long-term and in the short run we address these. And I would say one of the pieces of this that I think is important is the way it's been structured. I've often said that what we would prefer as the university to have all of our money come directly and in no way connected. You know, we can just do what we want to do because we're academics. It has created an opportunity to engage with across agriculture through farm and commodity organizations broadly, and we can certainly look to do that more effectively over time. But it's been a way to start to engage in some of the most important issues, to understand what those challenges are, where we're directing those resources, and having that input. And at all times, we've been able to, and the group has worked together, to recognize that the university has its priorities because we are changing faculty positions. We are taking new avenues of research and trying to adapt to those as well. And I think it's a testament to this that it has created some of that trust that I think has been affected over time by us going our own ways. At the same time, we do need to, as academics, have that freedom to explore areas that are not necessarily, you know, directly immediately the case. So it's always a balancing act, and we're working to address that as well.
Thank you, Dean Boer. I think we have some questions. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a really quick comment. I just want to say for the record that I still think this should be a higher ed target number. And Representative Hamilton, I understand how you said this is making them more responsive to agriculture. University of Minnesota is our land grant research one institution. I certainly hope that in an ag state they're responsive to that regardless. I understand you're shaking your head no. I just think that this is something, with the limited budget that Ag has, that this is something that the higher ed does, and if the University of Minnesota views this as a priority, they would support that. Thank you.
Is there a comment, response, Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would absolutely disagree. With what we saw taking place with the Ag Special and what was going on in the higher ed, it was intentional to bring these dollars into the budget of the Agriculture Committee. And that way, if the university would look at redirecting these dollars in any way, shape, or form, we could then do a clawback and redirect these dollars somewhere else to address the needs as it pertains to agriculture. And in the defense of President Kaler, prior to him coming, I was on record saying that the University of Minnesota has turned their back on agriculture, and I was very adamant about that. In fact, when I brought that up to President Kaler right after he was assigned to that position, he actually used my quote in one of his speeches to the ag entities. And since then, to their credit entirely, university's credit, credit to Dean Brian Boer and others, they've had a strong focus on agriculture. But prior to that, I wasn't the only one that was critical to what was taking place, if you will. And so I would very much disagree with where you'd like to or what your thoughts are redirecting these into higher ed. They need to stay in agriculture for the reasons I just mentioned.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to thank Dean Boer, the University of Minnesota, for being one of the premier agricultural institutions in our country. I've been involved with the University of Minnesota, as you well know, for more than 40 years. It's an outstanding institution which has never turned its back on agriculture. The dedication of the professors and the students who come from the University of Minnesota to serve agriculture and food and natural sciences all across our nation is incredible. And Dean Boer knows that I would like to see the money go straight to the university. If a GREET is a compromise that gets money into the university for the valuable research that you do for all of us, and agriculture and food are more than just these institutions which are listed on this piece of paper of support. And I would like to say that we need to be really careful about the institutions and to hold them up so that they can continue to grow and to develop and to serve our state. We are a state deep in our heritage of agriculture, and so I just couldn't handle the comment that the university is not stood by agriculture. So there isn't really a question in here. I'm willing to support this money if it gets to the university to be used for all of food and agriculture. And that's what I'll say. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
If we have time, Madam Chair, thank you. Dean Boer, you mentioned the African fever. Over the last weekend, a shipment of pork from China was confiscated at a port in New Jersey, I believe. How serious was that, and what's being done to maintain that doesn't happen in this country?
Dean Boer.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I apologize. I wish that Dean Trevor Ames from the vet school was here to discuss what the challenge of that is. Of course, I do know enough to know that we do have federal inspection laws for shipments coming into the country. I think the challenge will be that oftentimes, you know, it's the vectors are through feed as well as meat products in this case and so on. And so I think the challenge is, you know, how do you assure that every one of those vectors is captured in that testing? So it is a serious challenge. That's part of the surveillance question we're working on, is how you surveil. And I know there's a lot of effort being made on trying to assure that we don't have those shipments coming across borders. But the unfortunate reality with some of those diseases are they're borne by many vectors and very difficult to control.
All right. Any other committee questions? Just I'm going to state for the record that I think we should increase the ag specials and continue to fund through the ag budget. So I think that because actually the ag specials has been reduced, we could at least get back to what it was 10 years ago. So $10 million addition would get us back to 10 years ago. If we could do even more, we could get back to where we were
probably 15, 20, 30 years ago. But so I do think that we should be looking at the higher ed budget and increasing the ag specials, but I know I can recognize the importance of putting things through ag as well. So, Representative Hamilton or Dean Boer?
Well, Madam Chair, if I can make a quick comment, I just want to state, you know, my gratitude for it. I do view there as being strong support for agriculture. I think that's why this bill is here. I think in general there has been strong support. I appreciate the remarks regarding support for agriculture and food in Minnesota. I think we share that ethos here. I do, of course, you know, in the comments regarding the university, you know, we support the university's request. And a quick side to that, a technical detail that sometimes gets lost, there are general appropriations to the university, because state special is in that university appropriation, it receives any additional O&M dollars like all other programs at the university, but it certainly is not, if you look at the difference that's there because of reductions in it, it's not offsetting, certainly. So I do, of course, as a matter of the record as well, support the University of Minnesota's full request and priorities in this. They have been successful at helping us maintain our capacity that is critical to what we do.
And Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton.
And Madam Chair, I do support your comment as well, if we can, in both areas. But we cannot forget why we're here. Mm-hmm. And the reason why all the various groups came to us in the Ag Committee in order to establish this and fund it the way that we did, we can't forget that. And so that, Madam Chair, I would ask for your support and renew my motion.
Thank you. Thank you. The bill will be laid over. Thank you for that opportunity. Now I'm going to go to the next bill, which is my bill. So I'm going to have Jeff Grand. Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1351 be held over for possible inclusion.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So this is House File 1351. It's really about making homegrown renewable energy widely available to Minnesotans. This has been an issue that's been around for a couple of years, but it really is to address the availability, more the greater availability for the fuel, known as E15 or 88, and helping to Minnesotans to understand when they go to the pumps what is available to them and maybe why they should make certain choices when it comes to the kind of fuel they use. So it's modeled after the Biofuel Infrastructure Partnership Program, which was implemented by the Department of Ag, and that used federal funds to help 137 fuel retailers transition to E15 at the dispenser and to stimulate another 188 retailers to do the same. By the end of December 2018, a total of 325 fuel retailers offered E15, and that's a really good number, but what we'd like to do is make it an even better number. So the amount in this bill would bring us to approximately 660 fuel retailers, and those can be locally owned, independent operated retailers, and that they can then begin to offer E15. And then the second part of the bill also does raise the awareness of the program, and I've got a test fire here who can speak to all of those issues, so if I can just turn it over to the test fire.
Yep.
Thank
please
you.
State your name and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tim Rudnicki, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association. It's a trade organization that represents ethanol producers in Minnesota. And I'm here to say that we are in strong support of House File 1351 for the reasons Representative Poppy have noted. And also I'd like to underscore a couple of other points. This is about more than just ethanol and about dispensing and storage equipment for ethanol. It's about fulfilling, it's a method by which to fulfill three public policy objectives. And I believe within your information packet there's a four-page case statement, and the live version of that document actually has hyperlinks to research organizations such as the National Renewable Energy Laboratory and Argonne National Laboratory, and I won't go into all those details, except to say the comments I'm going to make and the numbers I'm going to share with you are derived from reputable scientific organizations. So we are in strong support of this bill. We urge you to be supportive of this bill, and I'd like to give you a few reasons for that. So in addition to helping to fulfill the public policy aims under the biofuel law, under the greenhouse gas reduction law, and under the Department of Administration's obligation to look at using renewable biofuels, this is a tool by which to fulfill those three broad policy objectives. And I think there's something else that's a little bit more important here as well. Ethanol in Minnesota is more than a commodity. It's in 2018, 1.27 billion gallons of renewable ethanol was produced, and it supported about, according to the latest economic report, 20,137 jobs. And again, I'm more than happy to provide this committee with the full set of details, but that ranges from accounting firms to engineering firms to suppliers of equipment and hardware and enzymes and yeast, everything from virtually A through Z in the alphabet, and we have the data to share with you in that point. I guess just moving along quickly in the interest of time here, it's important to know that in 2018, the ethanol industry contributed $1.74 billion to household income, paid $204 million in state and local taxes, and contributed to the GDP on the order of $2.31 billion. And maybe just to kind of bring all these points together, every gallon of renewable ethanol sustainably produced in Minnesota displaces a gallon of petroleum that would otherwise have to be imported into Minnesota. And to wrap some metrics around the implications there, based on research done by Dr. Stephen Mueller with the University of Illinois Chicago, he's advised us that the current level of ethanol use is cutting, well, first of all, improving air quality, and it's also cutting greenhouse gas emissions on the order of 712,000 tons every year. And if you were to do an equivalency calculator through the EPA, that's the same as removing the number is 150,527 vehicles from the road every year. So that's just with ethanol where we're at. With Representative Poppe's bill, the potential not only to fulfill three key policy objectives exists, but it can also help us reduce another 358,000 tons of greenhouse gas emissions, and that would be the equivalent of taking an additional 75,368 vehicles off of Minnesota roads. And as Representative Poppe noted, House File 1351 does mirror the Biofuel Infrastructure Partnership, which was successfully implemented under the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And the beauty of that successful program is it provided a wonderful template for facilitating House File 1351 and accomplishing the three policy objectives around replacing petroleum, decreasing GHG emissions, and helping the state agencies use more renewable fuel. And maybe just one more context number. As you can see from the chart in your information packet, the number of retail stations went from, it was 26 with a 3 million gallon annual sale to 325 at the end of 2018, and that was a 60 million gallon sale of ethanol. So the context point here is that sounds like a lot, and we made some tremendous progress, but the reality is every month, in Minnesota, we consume 160 million gallons of petroleum gasoline. So there's lots of room for biofuel to serve Minnesotans and improve the environment and boost the economy. And with respect to the number of retailers that could benefit from this program, I'll just give you a little bit of context there. Some retailers, as we've noted in the past, have the potential to do simple calibrations of their dispensers to maybe on the order of a couple of $100. At the other end of the spectrum are retailers that are locally owned, independently operated, who would use some help with replacing dispensers, which is a bit more expensive. And at the far extreme of that spectrum would be replacing dispensers and and pipes and underground storage tanks, which could run in the order of several hundred thousand dollars. So it's a broad spectrum. But again, under the BIP program with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, there's a tremendous success model to follow and a template that can provide a lot of guidance. And I guess the last set of numbers I'd like to share with you, because with respect to your duties and obligations and what's at stake here, it's important you know that there is some other spin-off benefit to House File 1351. Once again, we asked an economist working under ABF Economics to give us some sense for what this bill could do. And taking those numbers and doing some extrapolation, the bill in the current form would not only expand availability of E15 and higher blends of ethanol, but it's expected that it would add $13.9 million to Minnesota GDP, support 187 jobs, which range in industries from doing underground storage tank installation to blender pumps, and also add an estimated $11.2 million to household income. So I guess to kind of wrap this all up, in our estimation, House File 1351 truly can unlock more potential of renewable ethanol made right here in Minnesota, and it can truly boost energy independence, consumer value at the pump, also boost the economic numbers, and do a lot to further improve the environment. So we urge you to give strong consideration and support to this bill for all these reasons. Thank you very much, and I'm more than open to taking questions.
Thank you, Mr. Renicki. Anybody else that would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, seeing no one. Anybody that would like to ask any questions to the testifier or the bill author? Okay, seeing no one. Seeing no further discussion. Chair Poppe, would you like to have some closing statements?
Just that this bill will be laid over. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, with that, I will make the motion to lay it over. And then before we end the meeting, would you like to make any announcements before we close?
Just, again, we'll have a meeting on Thursday, and we'll be going through many, many more bills. And I know we're being aggressive in our time, but we know that we have things that have to get done in a short amount of time, and everybody hopefully appreciate that. So thanks for, again, accommodating your schedules to be able to be here during that time. Thank you.
With that, meeting adjourned. Thank you very much.